This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You open the auditory door, you come on in and find out what's going on in the world. And do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to your friends. And a thanks to those of you who have recently reviewed us, including VHKP and Kaklimi. Yep, that's with two Ks at the beginning. If you enjoy this, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. 2 weeks ago, for example, we looked at whether we'd be willing to pay more tax to fund the NHS. In this edition, with Turkey, Russia, Iran and the United States all active in the war in Syria, I'm getting briefed on what the end game might look like.
Well, it began mid-afternoon. Live footage from the border was showing black plumes of smoke rising above Afrin, which is this enclave just across the border under the control of the Kurdish militia there, the YPG. Turkish F-16 fighter jets pounding Afrin from the sky, pounding targets from the sky. And then on the ground, there have been Syrian rebel fighters backed by Turkey as part of this offensive.
This week, Turkey invaded northwest Syria to fight the Kurds. It was another twist to the Syrian civil war, the conflict, which has been the signal disaster of the last decade, but which is supposedly nearing its end. Over the 7 years of war, the United States, Turkey, Russia and Iran have become increasingly important, either taking part directly or else supplying and equipping favoured groups. And these powers will, between them, shape the eventual outcome. So what I want to know today is what they want and how their relationships and rivalries are likely to play out. Step into the briefing room. Let's begin with this week's big intervener, Turkey, which shares a long border with Syria and has hosted up to 3 million Syrians fleeing the war. Joining me from Stockholm is Suat Kinikleoglu from the Institute for Security and Development Policy. At the beginning of the Syrian uprising in 2011, what was Turkey's initial approach?
Well, Turkey initially tried to convince President Assad to change the constitution, allow new political parties to be formed and go to an election immediately. Once Ankara understood that Assad was not going to listen to its advice, it turned quickly into supporting the rebels. It offered technical assistance, hosted them in Ankara and Istanbul. So Turkey took clear sides in the conflict.
And was its objective after that regime change in Syria?
Yes, its objective was regime change. Turkey communicated this openly. Turkey, we do forget, but by the time the Syrian conflict started, already revolutions took place in Tunisia, in Libya, and also in Egypt. And there was this air of inevitability that Syria would also follow through this trend that Assad would go. Turkey saw itself as a regional patron of these new revolutionizing countries who mostly, as we saw in Tunisia and in Egypt, turn towards Islamic Brotherhood type of governments. So Turkey saw a Turkish moment in the region. The Arab Spring, and especially the events prior to the uprising in Syria, gave the impression that Ankara was living a historic moment, making Turkey again a leader in the region.
How much did its strategy for the development of what would happen in Syria and elsewhere rely upon a perception of United States policy, what the United States would do?
Initially, the Turkish expectation was that the United States would take leadership and Turkey would be part of a coalition of countries. But in time, it became clear that the Obama administration was not interested in militarily getting involved in the conflict, at least not directly. The United States' lack of involvement created a vacuum, and as events later would show, that vacuum would be filled by Russia and Iran and others.
Russia actually did intervene directly in 2015. How much did that change things for Turkey?
Well, Turkey was extremely upset. It thought before the Russian intervention that things were going its way, that the Assad regime was receding step by step. But Russian military intervention, as well as strong political support in the United Nations Security Council, truly strained relations between Ankara and Moscow, to the extent that the Turkish Air Force shut down a Russian warplane close to the Turkish border.
Since then, the position seems to have altered. Can you tell us about that?
Exactly. Turkey reversed its policy, understood that it's not going anywhere, and joined Russia and Iran in trying to stabilize the conflict.
So what's the campaign in Afrin all about?
Well, the campaign in Afrin is really about Turkey's threat perception of the militant group PKK, whose affiliate, the YPG, in Syria has been carving out important parts of northern Syria, bordering Turkey's border with Syria. Turkey has been fighting a relentless war against the PKK over the last 40 years. Hence, Turkey's perception is that the YPG, which now controls considerable parts of northern Syria, is a threat to Turkey. This is not shared by some other countries, including the United States, who views the YPG as an important actor in the fight against IS. And that causes quite a bit of strain. But the current operation really is about Turkey trying to deter the consolidation of these Syrian Kurdish militants on Turkey's border and trying to establish a security zone to keep them away from Turkey's border.
What does Turkey want now? What does it think it can achieve?
Well, Turkey understands, of course, that Syrian Kurds are part of the Syria's population, but Turkey is extremely upset with this militant group whose affiliate is listed as a terrorist organization by the United States and the European Union, that it would not be dominating this entity, that other Kurdish components would also be able to breathe and have political influence. Of course, a political settlement in Syria, Turkey would have to accept its outcome. But I think Turkey's primary objective at the moment is to make sure that this militant group is not the dominant actor among Syrian Kurds.
Even if the price of that is to accept Assad remaining?
Well, I think on the discourse level, they do entertain the idea that Assad has to go. But I think they understood in realpolitik terms that this is not feasible in the short term.
Suat Kınıklıoğlu. Turkey may be a NATO member, but Russia's tacit cooperation assisted the Turks in this week's incursion. And it is Russia that is the most powerful ally of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Anna Borshchevskaya was born in the then Soviet Union, but now lives in the US and works at the Washington Institute think tank. She specialises in Russian foreign policy in the Middle East. Anna, can you talk first about the kind of military support that Putin and Russia has given to Assad and how important it's been?
Well, I think first it's important to remember that although Putin's September 2015 intervention in Syria shocked and surprised many, it was a long time in the making. And when it comes to Assad in particular, Putin supported Assad from the very beginning when protests broke out against him in Damascus in March 2011. And when it comes to military support in Syria, a lot of it has been air support. That has been a critical element of Putin's intervention in Syria in particular. You know, ostensibly, Putin said he came into Syria to fight ISIS. But the types of weaponry that they brought really had nothing to do with fighting ISIS. For example, they brought in anti-aircraft missiles. Well, ISIS doesn't have an air force. So why do you need weapons that are going to shoot down aircraft? And the answer to that is it was mainly a signal to the West, to the United States and to Europe. These were weapons that projected Russia's power, but also were a signal just by being there in and of themselves. They reduced American and European ability to maneuver militarily.
So what would have happened, do you think, militarily to Assad had Russia not intervened in 2015?
You know, by most analyst accounts, had Russia not intervened, Assad would have fallen. And it was really Russian air power that saved him back then.
Why did they decide to take such decisive action?
First, if we go back to the beginning of the uprisings in Syria, I think they scared Putin. I think they scared Putin the same way that the Arab Spring, all of Arab Spring scared Putin, because Putin doesn't believe that these events happened on their own. He's convinced that the West orchestrated these protests. He's convinced that the only way they can happen is if the West sponsors someone to do it. And when it happened to Assad, I think he saw himself. I think that's why it was so important for him to protect Assad. And Putin's priority is always regime survival. But he connects his own regime survival to what happens in the West. So for him, it's zero sum. For him to win, for his regime to survive, the West has to lose.
How successful do you think his strategy has been in Syria? Now, obviously, he saved Assad. So from that point of view, he's been successful. Otherwise, do you think he's achieved what he wanted to in that country?
I think for the time being, certainly he has achieved a lot. He very successfully took advantage of ambiguities and inconsistencies in Western policies towards Syria, and he was able to step in and project himself, project Russia's power, project Russia's interests as he defines them, and he was able to push for the type of solution that he envisions in Syria.
What do you think the Russian estimation of Assad himself is? Do you think they see him as somebody who can keep Syria together in the long term, or do you think they see him as a stopgap?
It's a little bit hard to tell, but you know, on the one hand, Russian officials always say, if you listen carefully, they say, we're here because the Syrian regime invited us and we support the legitimate government in Syria. And in this way, they always signal that they're less wedded to Assad himself. At the same time, it's hard to imagine who's coming in his place. And whoever does come, it would have to be, from the Kremlin's perspective, somebody who, just like Assad, ensures their interests in Syria. And in that sense, wouldn't be very different.
Anna Borshevskaya. Before Russian forces were active in Syria, President Assad's main ally on the ground was Iran. I'm joined now by Dr. Ali Alavi, who was born in Tehran and now teaches international politics at the London School of Oriental and African Studies. Dr. Alavi, if we go back to 2011, when the Syrian civil conflict started, what was Iran's strategy back then?
Well, this is very important to first look into the history of Iran's relations with Syria. After the revolution in Iran 1979 and then during Iran-Iraq war, the only Arab country within the region supported Iran was Assad's Syria. So Iran established a kind of alliance with Syria's Assad. When 2011, the Syrian uprising began, Iranian state seemed anxious. And observing the developments in Syria to see to what extent it may go, because it would affect the alliance with Syria, and more importantly, its alliance with something so-called axis of resistance. It means Hezbollah and Iran's access to the Levant.
So this is Hezbollah, which is the militia in Lebanon.
Yes.
Which was anti-Israeli and represented the Shia community in Lebanon.
Well, Syria's Assad provided a platform and a bridge between Iran and Hezbollah. Therefore, the alliance between Iran and Assad Syria is, from Iran's point of view, very important, very strategic. So the survival of Assad's government was seen as a kind of a priority for Iran as a part of that alliance.
How much physically did it do to support Assad?
Well, if we compare Iran's involvement in terms of physical involvement with Russia, Iran didn't enter the field officially by sending the troops and military hardware. Iran, first of all, supported by providing the consultations, military consultations, and also blessing Hezbollah's presence in Syria. So in other words, a more indirect military involvement rather than as direct as Russian Federation. You could see Russia involved more directly in that conflict.
Now, before the Russian intervention, Iran must have worried for a while that Assad could actually lose.
Yes, you could see Iran also had some discussions and contacts with the opposition forces to see to what extent this can be sorted within around the negotiation table. But yes, Iran was nervous when witnessed that the ISIS was emerging and using that fertile land to implement his agenda.
So Iran must have been strangely pleased when Russia intervened so strongly in Syria.
Yes, I should say, because from their point of view, anything that could help stability of the state under the Assad and removal of extremist groups, specifically in this context, ISIS, would be received as a kind of positive message.
What is Iran's relationship with Assad as an individual? Is he important as an individual, or could Iran cope with losing him as long as there was a relatively friendly replacement?
For Iran, stability of Syria was the priority. And then having the bridge between Tehran and Hezbollah, this is the priority. Of course, President Assad was the person who materialized that during the, and he is his father. So for Iran, it's not about the individual. It's not about supporting one specific president. It's about supporting a system and supporting an alliance that was shaped since the 1980s. I don't think it was specifically about supporting an individual per se.
How do you think the Iranian authorities and strategists are imagining the Syrian war will end?
I think now that the Assad, thanks to Russian intervention, is grasping power and then regaining its most of Syrian territory, from Iranian point of view, I assume they believe that it may end up in the way that they wished, which is Syria more stable, coming out of that war and going through kind of a transition process. So either with President Assad or without President Assad, but it seems the civil society and the governmental system remains in power. So I think they see it in quite much less anxious than before.
Ali Alavi. Good news for Iran is rarely regarded as good news for the United States. So what about the greatest power of all? Last week, Donald Trump's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson outlined five American desires for Syria. Foremost was stopping the country being a haven for terrorists. Next came a peace process leading to post-Assad leadership. And third was a diminution of Iranian influence. But what position is the US in to gain any of these objectives? From Smith College in Massachusetts, I was joined earlier in the briefing room by Professor in Middle East Studies, Steve Heidemann. Steve Heidemann, how would you characterize US foreign policy as evolved in Syria?
Well, I think we've seen very modest evolution in the transition from President Obama to President Trump. Neither administration was significantly interested in a direct or large-scale U.S. role in Syria. For the Obama administration, at the outset of the conflict, there was some hope that the U.S. could help shape conditions that would induce the Assad regime to negotiate a political transition and achieve political reform. When ISIS became a significant threat in Syria in early 2014, U.S. priorities shifted, and the focus became more narrowly directed toward the elimination of ISIS. And that has also been the chief priority of the Trump administration.
We've had a recent speech by the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. Did you read into it any kind of alteration in U.S. policy?
I think it's an aspirational attempt to shift U.S. policy in the region. and to use the presence that the U.S. has on the ground in Syria, small presence but not insignificant, to try to apply pressure on Iran to contribute to what has been a principal goal of the Trump administration, which is, as they describe it, the rollback of Iranian influence in the region. And they are using the Assad regime as what they hope will be a lever to help them achieve this influence over Iran and to help them achieve this goal of containing and rolling back Iran. Unfortunately, what we also see is this hallmark of U.S. policy towards Syria, which is setting out fairly ambitious aspirational policy goals, but not providing the kind of resources or political commitment needed to achieve them.
Is there any way in which the Trump administration and the American establishment regards involvement, what involvement there is in Syria, as a useful way of maintaining in the world's eyes the fact that the U.S. has capability?
It's an interesting question. I think there's far less concern with asserting U.S. influence in the Middle East under the Trump administration or under the Obama administration than we have seen at any time in the post-Cold War period. The Trump administration, like the Obama administration, is far more willing to take a back seat and to delegate a lead role in Middle East security issues and in Middle East diplomacy to regional actors, to Russia, and to the states it views as its core partners in the region, notably Israel and Saudi Arabia.
What do you think the danger of that effective withdrawal is?
One of the things that we see as a result of U.S. disengagement is that all of the parties in the region who benefited from having the U.S. more directly involved in the region are now experiencing a great deal more difficulty in securing their positions, in advancing their interests through negotiations. And I'm including not only the Syrian opposition, but in fact other groups with which the U.S. has traditionally allied in the region. And so what we see is a region in which diplomatic processes and the conflicts that are unfolding on the ground are playing out in ways in which the U.S. really has very little visibility, little influence, and little leverage.
Are you saying that a U.S. withdrawal of this kind actually makes armed action on the part of countries like Saudi Arabia and Israel that bit much more likely?
I do, and I think we've seen one of the most significant effects of that approach in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia has been involved in a very brutal bombing campaign with many civilian casualties. But we see it in Syria as well, where it seems as if the U.S., for example, has at least acquiesced, if not endorsed, this recent Turkish invasion of the town of Afrin in northern Syria.
Steve Heidemann. So much for a whirlwind tour of the main external forces involved in Syria. Here in the briefing room now to help me draw some conclusions from these disparate sources is Lina Khatib, who is head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House in London. Lina Khatib, what do you think the future holds for Assad?
I expect we're going to see more of the same for a while. When it comes to governing, this is an interesting question because he is indeed in charge of several areas in Syria and he's expanding his control. But we have to ask, what kind of governance are we talking about?
So do you think we are talking about a return to the Syria that existed before 2011, or will it always be something different?
The Syria that we had before 2011 is sadly gone forever. There is now a new, more fragmented Syria, a Syria that will require at least 30 years, a generation, to be restored to at least the basic level that the state had in terms of capacity before 2011. So the groups that have sprung up in Syria as well since 2011 are not going to go away anytime soon. And the social grievances, of course, are going to have a long-term impact on cohesion in the country.
Let's look a little bit about the price that Assad has had to pay. Obviously, he has been kept in power, but he's been kept in power by the intervention of foreign countries, particularly by Russia. To put it crudely, do you think Putin now owns Assad?
Well, if you look at the latest visit by Putin to Syria, he looked like he did indeed own Assad. I mean, Assad wasn't allowed to, at one point, walk next to him. He had to stay behind and let Putin lead. That was a very symbolic image that was circulated worldwide that showed who really calls the shots in Syria now. It's Russia.
Do you think the Syrians recognize that themselves? Do you think Assad recognizes that himself?
I think he reluctantly does, and definitely the community around Assad also does. But for them, you know, having Russia there compared with Iran, they kind of prefer Russia because culturally it is a bit more palatable than the Iranian revolutionary project that remains a bit alien to the Syrian community around Assad in particular.
What do you think the Iranian view is of this increased Russian influence in Syria?
They feel that Russia is derailing some of their plans in Syria. So Iran is concerned that Russia might not act in its interests in the long run.
Does Iran have any way of countering that Russian influence, or is it just going to have to accept it?
Well, on the ground, we have seen certain incidents in which there were standoffs between Iran-supported militias and the Russians inside Syria. And we also have to remember that Russia has a good relationship with Israel as well. It's also known in certain circles that intelligence services in Russia and Israel do exchange information, much to the detriment of Iran.
Are there any possible replacements to Assad in Syria who could more easily fulfill the objectives which Assad's current allies have for the country?
When it comes to Russia, I think they don't really care who is in power as long as that person or group of people implement Russia's interests inside Syria. Perhaps someone from the military community might be an acceptable alternative were a settlement to the Syrian conflict be reached.
So you think Assad won't last?
Right now, he's only in power because the Iranians and the Russians are allowing him to be in power. But if they see that it's in their interest to have a bit of a deal on Syria that requires a bit of a symbolic sacrifice, then he's going to be that symbolic sacrifice.
What would be their mechanisms for replacing him? How would that happen?
Election laws can be tweaked at the last minute. He may no longer be eligible for whatever reason. He may suddenly find himself too old or too young they'll find a way.
What has Assad made of Turkey's recent intervention?
Turkey's recent intervention is primarily about the Kurds. So right now, the YPG that is basically being attacked by Turkey has had a very pragmatic relationship with Assad. So Assad himself is not going to see in the Turkish intervention a big threat to this group because, you know, he doesn't really care all that much at the end of the day.
But what about the idea that it gives Turkey carte blanche, in a sense, to intervene over the Syrian border if it sees itself threatened, for the future?
I think here we have to look at the relationship between Turkey and Russia. Russia so far has not really done much to kind of stop Turkey from going ahead with this military attack. And interestingly enough, neither did the United States. And to me, this shows that the Turkish-Russian relationship is another uncomfortable one that has happened out of pragmatism just because Turkey felt let down by the US. If later on Russia decides that it's not in its interest, then it might be a different situation and it might try to cause some problems for Turkey. So it is a dance. It is a game. Right now it's tolerated. Maybe later on it won't be.
So the implication for NATO, from what you're saying, would seem to be that the experience has thrown Turkey and Russia slightly closer together, made Turkey and America slightly less close together and significantly reduced American influence in the region. Would that be a correct summary?
Yes, it is. And it's primarily because of US policy, because Turkey intervened in Syria thinking that the US would give it full support. The US didn't. Then when there was a coup attempt in Turkey felt that the US did not stand with the president, Erdogan. And meanwhile, Russia was putting increasing pressure on Turkey in order to weaken its links with Syrian rebels. And Russia succeeded. And so Turkey has said, well, what do we do? We need to survive.
So what kind of change by the US would Turkey welcome?
There are two things that Turkey wants. The first one is for the US to stop its support for the Kurds. The second thing that Turkey wants would be some form of US leadership to settle the conflict in Syria. Because at the end of the day, Turkey will not benefit from having instability in Syria.
Lena, thank you. To try and sum up on all this, the Russians now have President Assad in their pocket. The Iranians are broadly satisfied that their strategic objectives are being met. And the Turks seem to be into damage limitation. The US huffs and puffs around, but with the defeat of ISIS is essentially disengaged. An uneasy calm is descending. My thanks to all my guests, Anna Borshchevskaya, Suat Kanikolioglu, Dr. Ali Alavi, Steve Heidemann and Lena Khatib. Until the same time next week, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.